Our next case is case number 70164, First Transit versus Chernikov. We have Mr. Pulsenberger representing the appellants, Mr. Cloud representing the respondents. Mr. Eccles here, I see here too as well. Thank you. Okay, first of all, Chief Justice Douglas and Justice Cherry, as you know, will be retiring at the beginning of January, so they're not going to participate in a decision in this case. Justice Stiglitz will participate, and you can see her by video as she's participating today from Carson City. So with that in mind, Mr. Pulsenberger, I assume you'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to try to save 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. Okay, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Presiding Justice Gibbons. May it please the Court, Dan Pulsenberger for the appellants. A new trial is necessary in this case because the district judge did not put the plaintiff's decedent on the comparative negligence special verdict form. This was error. This was error because NRS 41.141 expressly directs the jury to consider the comparative negligence of plaintiff's decedent.
Did you object to your
Oh, yes. Yes.
The court overruled that objection on the verdict form.
The court went on for pages and pages trying to decide whether the parent should be on the verdict form, whether the decedent should be on the verdict form, or whether both of them should be on the verdict form. And she ultimately decided just the parent should be on there. But the although the restatement provides that both can be on there, it's pretty clear under Nevada law the decedent has to be on there. It's written into the statute. In fact, there's a case from before the passage. Even before the original passage of 41.141 in 1973, a case that accrued there, Fennell versus Miller, a 1978 case that accrued in 1971. And there the plaintiff's decedent was contributorily negligent because it was before the passage of the comparative negligence statute. And this court said that no, the plaintiff could not recover at all. I already mentioned the restatement. Restatement of Torts, Apportionment of Liability, Section 6, makes clear that a party, this was our argument throughout the district court, where a party is attempting to recover derivatively of a third party, that third party's negligence must be taken into account. And there's even a federal court case, Moyer versus the United States, where Judge Reed said that the amount of the recovery must be reduced by the amount of the negligence attributable to plaintiff's decedent. And we can find that case if we look up NRS 41.141. That's a headnote in NRSA under wrongful death. It's also a headnote in the NRS published by the state. And the heading there says recovery diminished by the amount of the plaintiff's decedent's comparative negligence. Okay. So that was error as a matter of law.
Mr. Pulsenberger, did you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Mr. Pulsenberger, I know we have a short amount of time and a lot of issues here. I know the court is also concerned about the number of the issues, but including the heightened standard instruction.
Yes.
And also on the closing argument, whether there's
very good, enough, and I promise to get to all three.
Thank you very much. Justice Hardison had a question.
So before we get to the other ones, I'd like to stick to this one about the instruction. I understand your argument about whether Harvey should have been listed or not, but as a threshold question, In what way did your clients maintain that Harvey was negligent at all? What did he do that would justify the giving of a comparative negligence instruction?
Well, Your Honor, to me, this was really a last clear chance type of case if we're going to use old contributory negligence standards. This wasn't a typical, and I'm slightly making a transition to the other issues, this isn't a typical common carrier case where we have an obligation to protect the passengers from influences on the outside. He caused his own choking. They contend that he was choking. We said it also could have been a heart attack, but they said he was choking. The evidence is, and I'm entitled to all the inferences on this claim because my issue of comparative negligence, contributory negligence, did not go to the jury. So it's effectively a JMOL on my affirmative defense. So he was gobbling. He knew there was a rule against eating on the bus. He knew
it wasn't. It seemed to be a rule that was focused on sanitary conditions of the bus, not the health of its passengers. Well,
the evidence was, right. The evidence was both. The evidence at trial was that it was for both reasons.
So there's evidence from whom that it was a health reason?
The plaintiff's first witness was our director of safety. I don't remember her name, but Mr. Cloward got her to admit that one of the reasons there was to prevent people from choking. So he knew there was, remember, I'm entitled to all inferences on this claim that I didn't get to the jury. So he knew there was a rule that he wasn't supposed to eat on the bus. He was eating on the bus. He was ducking down so he wouldn't be seen. He was, in the words of one of the experts, gobbling the peanut butter sandwich down very hastily in a way that could cause choking. He was hunched over, trying to avoid notice. So under those circumstances, it really was Mr. Chernikov who caused the choking. And we're being sued for not being able to come in and save him from himself. So under those circumstances, there was enough for the issue to go to the jury. We have an entire section in our opening brief that we refer to in our reply brief explaining what the evidence is, why this should have gone to the jury. What they rely on mostly...
The fact of the matter is, though, that you did not submit a form of verdict that included Harvey on the verdict form, correct?
I don't think anybody submitted a form until we decided the issue of who was going to be on the verdict form. But all it needed was one more line, and I played around with the idea of bringing a mock-up of the verdict form and a post-it note that comes across, right, just adding his name and the percentage.
And you would get to the same result anyway, had there been an instruction that the negligence, if any, of Harvey should be attributed to the parents for purposes of completing the verdict form, right, or not?
That's not the way anybody at trial approached it.
Okay.
The way they approached it was putting him on there because the negligence of the decedent could be attributed. And I think under the statute, it probably works better just having the decedent on, because it does have the jury consider the comparative negligence of the plaintiff's decedent.
Right. So you're advocating, if you were writing the law here, you would say the decedent in this situation should be on the verdict form because it's a derivative claim.
Yes.
And that would be the analytics.
Yes, and I think that reflects the wording of 41.141. I also think it...
41.141 is a bit problematic wording-wise.
Well, that's because it's been changed so many times.
Yeah. Because it seems to suggest that, but it's inferential, that the names on the verdict form should be those for the parties remaining in the action. That's the argument from the other side.
Well, and that is their argument.
Harvey's estate was not remaining in the action at the time that verdict went to the jury.
But even the estate would have been recovering derivatively of Harvey.
Yeah.
Part of the problem is in the 87 legislature, when they made the change from joint and several liability to several liability, and the court and the legislature thought they could take out a couple of lines in Section 2 and that just have the provision in Section 4 where the defendant is severally liable to the plaintiff only for the portion which represents its percentage of negligence. And the problem with that is, to make that clear, you'd also, remember, that wasn't the year they changed, it was in 79 that they changed the statute to add plaintiff's decedent, because that was the year that they passed the wrongful death statute. And as a result, the wording's a little awkward, but the only way I think to read it is to have the plaintiff's decedent on the verdict form, and then the defendant's liable for the percentage attributed.
Even though the estate's not a party.
Yes.
Mr. Polsenberg, can I just hop this? The respondents here are claiming that that issue was waived, that defense counsel acquiesced that both shouldn't be on the form, the parents and Harvey.
No, that didn't happen.
Can you explain that a little bit? I know in the judge's order she indicated that although Ms. Sanders retracted that position, it was procedurally improper
Well, that's not right.
I understand that.
That's not right, and this court has decided a lot of cases about what it takes to preserve an issue for appeal, and that's to give the district judge the chance to do the right thing. Now, at one point, Judge Miley said, well, I think it's more appropriate the parents be on there, and Mr. Alberson said, I guess you're right, and the very next page, Leanne said, no, that's not right, it should be the decedent. Now, I've had senior partners interfere when I'm trying to do the right thing. And I think it's very clear what our position was that was being taken. And waiver is not raising the issue at all. This court cases all the way back to Otterbeck are if you don't raise the issue, you waive it. Not if you say, oh, wait a minute, Judge, here's the right thing. Remember, this court said in, Justice Gibbons is going to be mad I'm taking so much time, but this court said in Landmark versus Moore, what the trick is to give the district judge the chance to do the right thing. She had the chance to do the right thing.
What was her point indicating this was procedurally ineffective? I'm not quite sure I understood that.
I don't understand it either, and I've argued jury instructions a lot of times.
Okay, answer my question.
And I think we're absolutely right. They don't. What you're saying, Judge Miley said, they don't argue on appeal. All right. So Banks, they rely only on Banks, which goes to the portion of the statute that Justice Pickering talked about parties to the appeal. I think that refers, in the legislative history, it's clear from 1987, that's referring to settling defendants. It's codifying the rule in Warmbrot versus Blanchard, and Pat Cashel in 87 explained that. Let me get to the jury instruction issue. I think the next two issues actually are very easy, and I can handle them in about a minute. The jury instructions, it's inappropriate to give instructions 32 and 34 here because they were based on common carrier. Is there common carrier liability? Yeah, there probably is, but it doesn't apply here because to have an instruction on common carrier liability, it would have to do with the actual incidents of transport. I don't mean peripheral things.
It's a crash between the bus and another vehicle.
I had a case where a helicopter, the mechanic didn't put the cotter pin in, and the helicopter crashed. The maintenance is a common carrier issue. The driving is a common carrier issue. Getting people on board and off board. And in fact, when we argued jury instructions on this, counsel actually said, well, Your Honor, we don't have to debate whether we're a common carrier. We debate whether the instruction applies to the facts of this case. Judge Miley said the instruction did apply. We think that's error. Last issue is the excessiveness, although maybe on rebuttal we might get a chance to talk about Lee versus GNLV and duty. It's not a misconduct issue. Misconduct issue would be 49A2. It's a 49A6 issue. It's excessive damages resulting from passion and prejudice. And here, I think on the face of the verdict, it was excessive. It was 7.5 for pain and suffering, which was only seconds or minutes.
So you're not making the Leoshi argument?
I'm not making a Leoshi argument. I'm not saying it's misconduct. I'm saying it's excessive damages, but they were influenced by the closing argument. Mr. Clyward argued about the value of the decedent, and while I need to make clear to the Chernikovs, I don't disparage the value of Harvey's life, but to argue to a jury that the verdict should reflect the value of a human being, when the only elements of damages are the pain and suffering for seconds or minutes, and
the objection would have yielded the response, that's the value of that life to those people who are suffered the loss of
and that's what they argue in their brief. It's their foreseeable argument, but that's why my argument really is 7.5 is too much for pain and suffering. And an identical 7.5, which is also the fact that you have the same numbers, is also a reflection of passion and prejudice. And with that, I'll save my minute and 24 seconds.
Okay, Mr. Balzamore, we'll give you 3 minutes in rebuttal. We'll add 2 minutes to Mr. Clowery's time, so 17 minutes total.
Thank you. May it please the court, Ben Clowery for the plaintiffs. The Chernikovs are present in the courtroom. The justices have keyed in on all of the issues. I'd like to first start with Justice Gibbons, your comment regarding the waiver issue. Ultimately, there are six ways this court can confidently affirm this decision. First, Mr. Alverson's language was, quote, "I think that's probably true," and that's on page 1607. Now, the way that the transcript lays out is that on one page, it is true, Mr. Alverson agrees, and then on the next page, Ms. Sanderson stands up and tries to retract that, but that's not the way that it actually happened at the time of court. What happened was this was the very last argument that the parties had to address, and so the issue, the decision was made. Judge Miley said, quote, "I think so too," all right? The parties left. We were actually were not even in the courtroom. Myself and Ms. Brazier, we left the courtroom with
us. Does the record reflect that?
It shows that there's a transcript or a pause in the proceedings. And as
but it doesn't reflect that not all people were present in the courtroom, right?
It does, actually. Because the first time that Ms. Sanders tried to raise the issue, we weren't even in the courtroom.
How do we know that?
The transcript itself, if the court reviews the transcript, it says, oh, wait, I think the plaintiffs, there's nobody here for the plaintiff's counsel.
Okay.
And so then it was later on a second pause in the in the proceedings that we actually entered the room, and it was at that time that the decision, that the conversation continued. So there were two pauses in the transcript. As a matter of fact, if the court looks at the transcript, Judge Miley left the bench. She went to her chambers to retrieve something from her chambers. So that's the first issue. The second issue is that even after that, the district court gave the appellants the opportunity to preserve this issue on a number of occasions. First, at 1613, Appellate Appendix 1613, this was after the jury instructions were read to the jurors. The jurors were dismissed. This is Friday afternoon. The court said, quote, "The verdict form, you guys have both gone through it and it's acceptable, correct?" The answer, yes, end quote. They didn't raise the issue at that time. They didn't lodge.
They're already shot down on that issue. The judge ruled against them after there's made her attempted retraction, and they made their point. Why would they do it again and argue it on the jury form to be turned down? I don't quite follow you.
Okay. I believe it was a point that Justice Pickering was making about submitting an alternative form, submitting an alternative instruction, and then also doing an offer of proof. Those three things, pursuant to Banks v. Sunrise, which cites to Buck v. Greyhound and Carlton v. Manuel, very, very clearly point out, those three things have to be done to preserve that issue. You have to propose the instruction, you have to give an alternate verdict form, and you have to do an offer of proof. Otherwise, if you don't, it's waived. The fourth reason is that Kramer v. Peavy and Eberhard v. Baldwin, those cases stand for the proposition that after the verdict came back, so even though they had the entire weekend to think about this and show up on Monday before closings were given and say, you know what, Judge, we feel like we would like to have an instruction on this. We feel like we want a verdict form before this goes to the jurors. They didn't do any of that. After the verdict came back, these two cases stand for the proposition that they have to raise that insufficiency of the evidence at that time before the jurors are discharged, so that the jurors, if there's an opportunity to re-instruct the jurors and have them go re-deliberate, that can be done at that time. Otherwise, it's simply waived. Next, I would like to point to the language of the statute. NRS 41-141, I implore the court, go to your chambers after this is done and just print the statute. Print the statute and look at the language of 2B2 and simply replace, just cross off parties and put in their defendants and see what the result is. What the result is that you would turn comparative negligence upside down, because it would never, ever, ever allow any plaintiff to ever be charged with comparative negligence. And that's what they're asking the court to do. They're saying, look, Banks v. Sunrise, Warmbrot, those only apply to defendants. In all these legislative changes, in the 79 legislative change, in the 87, that was all talking about defendants. Go and simply cross parties off and put defendants and see what the result is.
So is it your argument that this statute supports old-style comparative negligence vis-a-vis a derivative claim on behalf of a plaintiff's decedent, but not contributory negligence where there's an offset for percentage liability or percentage contribution by the the decedent?
I think that...
Do you follow the question?
I think I understand the question, the difference between contributory versus comparative.
Yeah, because the statute quite clearly says if plaintiff's decedent is more than 50% liable, you're done.
Correct.
So that's a classic old-style comparative negligence. But what if the plaintiff's decedent is 20% at fault? You're saying that should not be subtracted or taken into account in this setting?
I think if the estate was still in the case, I think that's exactly the analysis. But they dismissed the estate. And so to you,
the comparative is only preserved if the estate remains in as a party?
Correct.
As to the plaintiff's decedent. I just want to understand your reading of this statute. It's a perplexing statute.
Yes. That is exactly my reading, because when you look at banks, banks talks about only having non-parties or parties remaining in the action, and there's a distinction there. Wormbrand also discusses that. So,
is there a distinction if we were to consider their claim as a derivative claim? Can you explain that a little bit?
I'm not sure that I understand the question.
Their claim would be derivative of Harvey's claim.
True.
Right? And so does that play any, does that have any significance in this discussion?
Well, I think the same analysis, if Harvey's claim, or if Harvey was still in the lawsuit, I think that you would just compare the negligence of all of the remaining parties in the case, regardless of whether it was derivative or not. Because, the whole purpose of the comparative negligence statute is to weigh the evidence of each individual's comparative negligence. And when they dismissed the estate, I mean, the whole argument in the briefs is that, look, Banks v. Sunrise only applies to defendants. That's the argument that they've made in their briefs, is that Banks v. Sunrise only applies to defendants. So my suggestion was for the court to simply go back and rewrite and just on 41-141-2B2, just cross off parties and put defendants and then reread the statute. It would never allow any plaintiff ever to be held for a comparative negligence.
Thank you,
Justice. Next, Justice Hardesty talked about the bona fide issue of the negligence. That's a great point. Now, I'd also like to just cite to the appellant's brief at 19. First off, we point out in our brief that they didn't cite anything in the record. This is a two-part analysis. Number one, it's the negligence, but also number two, it's the proximate cause. I would like to address both of those. They claim that we misrepresented the record. I would like to direct the court to the exact citation in the record so the court can review it for itself. Because they state, quote, "This court does not have to comb the record. It's all there. The testimony that the rule against eating was communicated to Harvey," end quote. That's their reply at 19. And then in support of that, they cite to cross-examination of Elaine Chernikoff, examination of Mr. J. Ferralis, and then the video itself. I'm asking the court to review Appellate Appendix 881 through 886, Appellate Appendix 1307 through 10, and then please review the video itself, Appellate Appendix 12 at 7:57 and 30 seconds through 8:03 and 30 seconds. Regarding Ms. Chernikoff's testimony, she was cross-examined, and this is what she said. Question: "Now, you didn't ever read the rules yourself, so you didn't read them to Harvey, did you?" Answer: "No, I did not." Then she was asked, question: "And you never told him not to eat on the bus, did you?" Answer: "No." That's at Appellate Appendix 886. So appellants have set forth Harvey knew of the rule. That's why this is a bona fide issue. That is not what the record reflects. Next, Mr. Ferralis, he testified very clearly. He never told Harvey not to eat on the bus because he never saw Harvey violate the rule. So he never had an occasion to tell him. So what appellants have stated in their brief, with all due respect, is simply not true. Second, appellants cite to the record and argue that the evidence showed that Harvey was intentionally hunched in his seat to avoid and hide his behavior. This is false. Please see 725 and 45, 753 and 30. Harvey couldn't even put on his own seatbelt at times, let alone formulate this sinister plan to hide this detection from the driver. Second, at 705 and 38, Harvey... pardon me. Harvey asked the driver to help him take a drink from the water. He hands his water back to the driver. The driver uncaps the water, puts the lid back on, or uncaps it, and then hands it to Harvey. This is not the action of an individual that was trying to avoid his eating and drinking on the bus. Third, almost an hour later, at 7:57 and 30 seconds through 8:30 and 30 seconds, the video shows that Harvey was dying. He was not hiding. He was dying at that time. The reason that the bus driver did not see Harvey was because he violated the bus rules to scan the interior of his bus every 5 seconds. The court can see at 8:03 and 30 seconds the first time it sees the sunglasses of the driver come into the view of the mirror, and it was at that time that the driver recognized he was in serious problems and pulled over the bus and checked on him. Until that time, he did not look at Harvey. Now, regarding his negligence...
Was there any testimony, Mr. Well, maybe you were about to get to this, but was there any expert testimony or other testimony that indicated that he died because
he
ate a sandwich too fast?
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. That brings me to my very next point. No, there is not. As a matter of fact...
And was that fact or that evidence described in the appellant's brief?
They did not address, to my knowledge, the proximate cause, as I recall. I've spent the last week preparing for this, but I do not recall that they addressed that. And that's a great point. That's my next issue. When you talk about the proximate cause, their entire argument from opening statement to closing statement was that Harvey died of a heart attack. Never one time did they concede that he choked. Never one time. Juror Letitia Brown, at page 1206, actually asked in a juror question, quote, "Do you feel that the food caused Harvey to have a heart attack?" Dr. McQuarrie never stated that it did. And in fact, his response was, quote, "Choking on something and causing a death? Boy, it is rare. Very rare." And then he reaffirmed his position that this was a cardiac death. Never once did they show that any negligence of him eating on the bus led to what they claim was a heart attack.
Second, Mr. Clark, can you get to the issue on the heightened standard?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Justice.
It's important to me. I mean, that particular issue.
Absolutely, Justice Gibbons. Regarding this, first off, the very first thing that I think the court needs to recognize is that in the briefs, they talk about that the issue was whether or not the duty was owed to passengers with disabilities, and then they said is, quote, limited to risks of transportation itself. That's at the reply of 24 through 25. The problem with that is absolutely not what was discussed at the time of trial. What was discussed at the time of trial was Appellate Appendix 1585 through 1587. The sole argument that was advanced by the appellants was the common carrier doctrine was only applicable to boarding and alighting cases. That was the sole argument that they advanced, is that, look, common carrier is only applicable when it's boarding and alighting. They cited to a 1955 case called...
Well, isn't that their point, though, with instructions 32 to 34, that it says there's this heightened standard that applies to common carriers, and it's more expansive than risks associated with transport, including alighting and boarding, traffic accidents, maybe assaults. But those instructions are pretty all-encompassing. Is it your point they didn't make that argument in trial court, or is it your point that that's not the law?
I'm saying, number one, both. It's not the law, and they did not make that argument. They're trying to say, look, the analysis is only risks limited to transportation itself. Well, number one, you didn't make that. You cited to the McBride.
I think the argument was that the heightened standard only, if there is a heightened standard, it only applies to risks associated with transport.
That's what they're making now. At the time of trial, they were saying, look, common carrier only applies when somebody's getting on and off the bus, period. That was the argument that they were making. And they cited the McBride case, and we were citing to the American President Lyons v. Lundstrom case, which the 2011 pattern instructions were based on. Ms. Brazier actually said, counsel, I don't believe that that's what that case stands for. Your Honor, I have a copy of the case if the, Your Honor would like it. And the judge had it there. And it was at that point that counsel for defendants said, well, hold on, I didn't mean to misrepresent it. They're correct. That case doesn't only stand for the proposition of boarding and alighting. But even
your theory of negligence is what here?
That there were a number of rules that they had instituted to care for people who were on the bus. They assumed the responsibility. If you even take their case,
McLeod. But what did they do or fail to do? The bus driver was the only bus employee on the bus, right?
Yes.
And he's driving.
Yes.
And what is it that he did or did not do that accounted for common carrier negligence?
Sure. There was a policy on the bus that he was required to scan the interior of the bus every 5 seconds. Both he and the 30B6 Jeff testified that the reason that they have that rule is because they're a company that specializes in transporting folks with disabilities, and that they know that those folks need protection from themselves, and they know that choking is a hazard that can cause death.
Okay.
He violated that rule 72 times. Not only did he violate that rule, but they had a company policy that was company-wide that required every single employee of that company to know page 68, 69, and 70 of the employee manual that was stroke identification, choking identification, and Heimlich maneuver. In Las Vegas, there was testimony that Jennifer McKibbins told the employees that they did not have to know those pages. The company, the president of the company said, in the first of the handbook, no changes can be made to this policy without my written permission. Yet that's exactly what they did here in Las Vegas. I'm out of time. If there are any other questions, I'm sorry I didn't get the other issue, the last issue.
Additional question. What say you to Mr. Polsenberg's argument that the damages are excessive and reflect passion and prejudice stirred up by, among other things, inappropriate comments in closing argument?
I think that the evidence was rich and very substantial as to the love that this family had for their child. The relationship between Jack and Elaine and their son Harvey, there is a dearth of information, a dearth of testimony that the jurors received. And regarding his death, their own expert said it's the most horrific way for a person to die. And importantly, in this case, the jurors didn't have to take my word for it. They didn't have to take Mr. Polsenberg's word for it, or Ms. Sanders or Ms. Robertson. They could see the video themselves. They actually had the actual evidence of his death. And so I believe that this court can very confidently affirm all of the district court's rulings. Are there any other questions that I can address?
No, thank you. Okay. Thank you for
the
additional time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Polsenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Here's why we need a new trial, because the jury was judging us by a higher standard of care than appropriate and not judging the plaintiff's decedent's own negligence in creating the situation.
But I think Mr. Clyre is saying that the trial counsel for your client didn't make that argument, did they?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. What he said was, an argument never raised in their briefs is everybody was out of the room when we retracted. But no, on page 1608 of the record, there is a pause in the proceedings. Ms. Sanders starts to argue, and the court says, do we have an attorney for the plaintiff? Another defense lawyer says, no, she disappeared. Well, let me go get her. And then there's another pause in the proceedings, and Ms. Brazier is obviously back at that point, and Ms. Sanders raises the argument that it's not appropriate.
What page is that, 1608?
1608. So,
you say obviously back, but how is it obvious that they're back? Is there a statement that the person is back?
Ms. Sanders argues, and the very next page at line 4, Ms. Brazier argues.
Okay.
So they argue back and forth on that issue. So I never even heard this argument before. Now it's not in their briefs and it's not current. Counsel in their answering argument is essentially arguing the facts. And I'm entitled to the inferences on this issue. There's evidence that goes their way. There's evidence that goes my way. I mean, there was a sign there saying you can't eat. They're the ones who claim choking. But if they claim choking, while we claimed it was a heart attack, we're still in the situation where Mr. Chernikov caused the situation. What's our duty to come in and prevent that, and what's our duty of what to do? And it's
what
not,
say you to the violation of their own standards?
They never raised an assumed duty argument. That isn't what the case was about. It was a simple negligence argument, and even if it were an assumed duty argument, it's a situation where we're back to what I'm talking about. We were judged by a too high a standard under the jury instructions. Let me go to that point, too, because they're saying we only said it had to do with boarding and alighting. True, instruction 34 only has to do with boarding and alighting. It's the ADA instruction. 32 went to a lot of other things. But 1577 of the record, defense counsel says it has to do with, that this case is not at issue having to do with here, the boarding and alighting of Mr. Chernikov, turn the page, or the driving skills, the transportation of him. This was the recognition of a medical event. That's where we're arguing. This doesn't have to do with transportation. If I may, just a moment more.
Go ahead.
He argues insufficiency of the evidence. I'm not arguing insufficiency of the evidence. I'm arguing legal error. He says we only look at defendants. I argued a case years ago, Levy-Watts, where this court made it clear that what we're looking at is each individual plaintiff and each individual defendant's. But in this situation, when we're dealing with a wrongful death case, the statute expressly exempts this out.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank Professor. You, Your Honor. We never got to Lee versus GNLV, and that would have been a great argument. Thank you very much.
Well, we've heard of it before. Okay. Well, thank you both for your excellent arguments and briefs. I mean, you've served your clients well, and we appreciate your efforts, and we will take this matter into submission at this time.